Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Evidence of our changing climate is all around us. For many people who live and play in the Sierra, the Thanksgiving holiday usually means the start of winter sports. But little snow has fallen so far, and many area resorts have pushed back their opening dates. Hugh Safford is a fire and vegetation ecologist at UC Davis, and he's often thinking about the effects of climate change on forests. Back in 2024, he stumbled upon California's highest tree in the High Sierra, and it was a Jeffrey pine. That stumble ended up leading to an extreme tree hunt for Hugh and a team of researchers. They ended up traversing 240 miles to learn more. Hugh is here today to talk about what he learned about climate change on this extreme tree hunt. Welcome back to Insight, Hugh.
Hi, Vicky. It's good to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the star of this conversation, the Jeffrey pine. What does a Jeffrey pine look like? Where are they normally found?
So Jeffrey pine is under good growing conditions. It's a tall, straight tree. It'll have red, platy bark when it gets old. Pretty easy to identify in subalpine forest because it has three needles and no one else does. Has this wonderful vanilla or butterscotch smell that emanates from the bark. Don't know if you've ever tried that. It's actually relatively closely related to the much more widely distributed ponderosa pine, which maybe you've heard of or a lot of people have. They're sort of like the country cousins of ponderosa pine. They live in more difficult places, colder places, higher elevations, poor soils. They're stress tolerators, basically. And one of the things that's really key about them is that they have really big seeds, much bigger than ponderosa pine. And what that means is that they are a major food source for a lot of rodents and for a lot of bird species. And as a result of that, they're able to disperse further than most pines can, which are reliant on this little wing that's on their seed and a little bit of wind help, you know, and they get released from the pine. And in terms of where they are, strictly speaking, sort of between 5 and, say, 9,000 feet typically, a little bit lower in northwestern California. Their distribution is kind of interesting. It follows the terrestrial side of the North American Mediterranean climate zone, you know, this place that we live, that we're used to, that has a very, very dry summer. So they're common in southwestern Oregon, northwestern California. They're common in the Sierra Nevada along the western Nevada border. And we find them in northwestern Mexico as well. So if you visit Lake Tahoe, Mammoth Lakes, Truckee, Big Bear Lake, you know, Idlewild in SoCal, you'd see lots and lots of Jeffrey pines.
So what's so special about the Jeffrey pine that you stumbled upon and really kind of sparked this expedition for you and a team of researchers?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is that Jeffrey pine doesn't belong at those elevations. And, you know, this kind of field science and a lot of science is driven by serendipity, right? And I think serendipity or luck very often is the product of not just having something happen to you that you don't expect, but being able to actually take advantage of it, i.e., I saw that tree and I knew it was a Jeffrey pine. I mean, most people climbing those mountains have no idea what the species are they're looking at. And I just thought, wait a minute, I'm at 11,800 feet and there shouldn't be any Jeffrey pine here. And so we've known forever that Jeffrey pine can grow higher than, you know, it's listed elevations. Like the Jepson flora is the catalog and the key to California plants. And it suggests that you can find Jeffrey pine to 10,200 feet, say. Before last summer, we knew there were about a dozen records of Jeffrey pine occurring above that, up to even 11,200 feet, something like that. And the, you know, but those were, you know, they were outliers. Since then, we found hundreds of Jeffrey pine that are above those elevations. And so the cool thing is that I think at this point we've worked out sort of the broad outlines about what's happening. And can I jump into that?
Yeah. Why is this happening? Because it wasn't just the one you stumbled upon, of course. Now there's hundreds.
Yeah, there are hundreds and hundreds of them. We've documented many hundreds, nearly 1,000 Jeffrey pine from high elevations. Of course, that's specifically what we've been looking for, right, for this last summer in particular. And so a key player is the Clark's Nutcracker. And the Clark's Nutcracker is this really cute, medium-sized, black, gray, and white jay that you'll hear squawking in higher elevation forests all the time. And it is a really important consumer and disperser of the seeds of high elevation pines all over Western North America. And so at elevations like near timberline, so let me make clear, timberline is the end of continuous forest. Treeline is sort of the end of those isolated, scattered, trees that are above timberline. In these environments, its preferred food is white bark pine or limbert pine, which have really, really big seeds, and they don't have a wing, so they're adapted actually to be moved by these birds. And so they're easy to eat, they're easy to cache, and they're easy to collect. And so most of the seeds that a nutcracker actually collects, and you can't even believe how many seeds these birds are collecting in a year. It's like between 30,000 and 100,000 each bird. And they move them miles and miles on the landscape. They might make hundreds and hundreds of flights, maybe even thousands of flights in a year to disperse them, because they don't eat most of the seeds that they're collecting immediately. They go and hide them. You know, like your dog might hide its bone under the sofa, or something. They're doing this constantly. Half their life is spent doing this because in the winter and the late spring at these elevations, there's no food on the landscape. So they can remember at thousands of places where they've cached these seeds, but they don't get to all of them, right? And a fair number of them will end up germinating. And for white bark pine and limber pine, that's normal, right? These species belong in this place. They're adapted to this cold environment. And so the white barks and the limbers that you see at high elevation, those are there because they were cached by Clark's Nutcracker, and they've germinated. Now, the issue with Jeffrey pine is that it's also distributed by Clark's Nutcracker, but it's not quite as preferred. Seeds a little smaller. It has a wing that the bird has to chop off. And then the bird, well, another thing, I got to say some other things about the bird because it's really a unique thing. These hundreds of thousands of seeds that these things are moving throughout their life, they carry 70 to 100 of them in a little pouch under their tongue, in their, inside of their head. And they're flying around with these things. And apparently they can carry up to a seventh of their weight. So can you imagine like stuffing a seventh of your weight under your tongue and then fly, being able to fly with this? And then you're, anyway, so it's kind of amazing what they can do. But they'll disperse Jeffrey pine as well. And but the issue is that Jeffrey pine really isn't a subalpine species, right? Or at least it wasn't, right? And so what we found now is the oldest Jeffrey pines we found at tree timberline are like 30-ish years old, okay? But as you go uphill, they become younger and younger and younger. And at the top of the range, which right now is up to about 12,600 and, something feet, they're 1 to 10 years old. So what's going on? Well, it appears as if basically, you've got gradually increasing temperatures and there's this environmental window in which Jeffrey pine can germinate and survive that is opening and moving uphill over time. And it's still too cold for them to grow large or to produce cones at those elevations. But I think my assumption is that at some point, they'll be able to do both, unless climate warming reverses, which I don't think that's going to do that anytime soon.
Is there anything problematic with this, the fact that Jeffrey pine is growing at higher elevations?
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's an interesting question, and there could be. I mean, it's an interesting story because it's kind of a cool thing. I like Jeffrey pine a lot, and finding it so high, I thought, wow, this is amazing. I'm watching, biological migration and distribution changes in time. But I think that once that time comes when they're able to produce cones, and become truly mature trees, I think there could be an explosion of Jeffrey pine at these elevations, at particularly in the southernmost Sierra Nevada, Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park in particular, I think. And this could lead to really major ecological changes because Jeffrey pine grows much more rapidly than any of the standard subalpine species. It is much more drought tolerant. It is much more fire tolerant. And it's also a fire promoter. So those three long needles it has are highly flammable. And they also form a litter bed, beneath the trees that is thick and very aerated and easy to ignite and to get a fire going. And I think it's probably going to greatly increase the probabilities that light ignitions turn into large fires.
I mean, for you and the team of researchers to come back with this information, there's a lot of sweat equity that goes into this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and the team of researchers traverse like 240 miles up 24 mountain peaks. Is this like just standard for like a fire and vegetation ecologist, or was this an extreme example of field work that you were doing?
Yeah, no, it's definitely not normal stuff. I mean, the work was largely done by volunteers.
Are you still sore?
not now, but I do a lot of this stuff for fun as well. But I have to admit that after 4 7-day trips and walking all those miles and climbing 70,000 feet, and we were in the field with 40-pound packs day after day after day at elevations where oxygen is only 50 to 60% of what it is at sea level. I mean, it takes a toll. I lost 10 pounds over the course of the summer, and I'm already skinny. This is, one of the things that actually worries me a little bit about where science is going is that science seems intent on handing everything off these days to computers and artificial intelligence. Yet there's a lot that you can't learn that way. And I'm afraid that we're going to lose our exploratory bent, that angle that we've got that really needs human brains and human feet and human eyes. And I think that's going to be a challenge, in the future. Remote sensing, for example, is another thing. We've used it to great effect in many studies, but it can't see these little trees. It can't measure their age or how many cones they have. It can't tell much about their health. It can't tell me how much this tree grew last year. And that's one of the reasons that subalpine forests are so poorly known is because, man, it takes an extreme amount of work, to get to these places. Hmm.
Yeah, in the last minute or so that we have, I mean, the work still continues for you. What do you hope people take away from this extreme tree hunt that you and your team just completed?
Well, one is, I think, what I just referred to that. Well, I think maybe a variant on that is that I want people to understand that common people, even with relatively little funding, who have the right level of fitness, but just a little bit of ecological or biological background can actually answer important scientific questions.
Like a citizen scientist?
Exactly. And we're really keen on engaging volunteers and moving forward that way, not only because it's cheaper, but people are exhilarated. They come out exhausted, but they're ready to go back in. Another one is this thing I talked about, natural history skills. I mean, they're so important, and I'm so worried. You think about botany departments in American universities, they basically disappeared. They don't exist anymore. So if you're applying for money out there, if you don't include a heavy reliance on AI, good luck getting funded. It's just not going to happen anymore these days. But like I said, you need human eyes, brains, and feet in the ground for a lot of this. And then the last thing I'll say is that, for the managers of these places, state, federal park systems, the National Forest System, and the people who work for them, this could be critically important information because subalpine forests are the forests that protect our major watersheds. They support a lot of rare and endemic species. The California Carbon Plan assumes that they are reliable carbon sinks. But what our work is showing and other people's work is that these systems are a lot more dynamic than we thought. And there's a lot of mortality happening in these places, and there are species moving up from below. So I think that, whether the news is positive or negative, that there's a lot to be worried about, but a lot to be interested in at the same time, And I think a bit of there's a lot of science and a lot of proactive management to be done.
Hugh, as always, thanks for joining us and taking the hike.
Thanks for helping.
Sharing what you learned.
Yeah, you bet.
Hugh Safford is a fire and vegetation ecologist at UC Davis. He and a team of researchers went on an extreme tree hunt for the Jeffrey Pine. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, send us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Sarit Lashinsky, Andrew Garcia, and Jen Picard. Insight's technical director and audio engineer is Mark Jones. Our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.